Side 4, Gateway. Continuing on page 164. I agreed. I suppose so, in some silly way. And I think you feel quite guilty about your lover, Gilles Clara Moynlin. I thrash about a little. It is fucking hot in here, I complain. Do you feel that either of them actively blamed you? How the fuck would I know? Perhaps you can remember something they said. No, I can't. It's getting very personal, and I want to keep this on an objective level, so I say, I grant that I have a definite tendency toward loading responsibility on myself. It's a pretty classic pattern, after all, isn't it? You can find me on page 277 of any of the texts. He humors me by letting me get impersonal for a moment. But on the same page, Rob, he says, it probably points out that the responsibility is self-inflicted. You do it to yourself, Robbie. No doubt. You don't have to accept any responsibility you don't want to. Certainly not. I want to. He asks almost offhandedly, can you get any idea of why that is? Why you want to feel that everything that goes wrong is your responsibility? Oh, shit, Siegfried, I say in disgust. Your circuits are wacko again. That's not the way it is at all. It's more... Well, here's the thing. When I sit down to the feast of life, Siegfried, I'm so busy planning on how to pick up the check and wondering what the other people will think of me for paying it and wondering if I have enough money in my pocket to pay the bill that I don't get around to eating. He says gently, I don't like to encourage these literary excursions of yours, Bob. Sorry about that. I'm not really. He's making me mad. But to use your own image, Bob, why don't you listen to what the other people are saying? Maybe they're saying something nice or something important about you. I restrain the impulse to throw the straps off, punch his grinning dummy in the face, and walk out of that dump forever. He waits while I stew inside my own head, and finally I burst out. Listen to them? Siegfried, you crazy old clanker. I do nothing but listen to them. I want them to say they love me. I even want them to say they hate me. Anything, just so they say it to me. From them, out of the heart. I'm so busy listening to the heart that I don't even hear when somebody asks me to pass the salt. Pause. I feel as if I'm going to explode. Then he says admiringly, you express things very beautifully, Robbie. But what I'd really... Stop it, Siegfried! I roar, really angry at last. I kick off the straps and sit up to confront him. And quit calling me Robbie. You only do that when you think I'm childish, and I'm not being a child now. That's not entirely... I said stop it. I jump off the mat and grab my handbag. Out of it, I take the slip of paper S.E.R. gave me after all those drinks and all that time in bed. Siegfried, I snarl, I've taken a lot from you. Now it's my turn. Chapter 18. We dropped into normal space and felt the lander jets engage. The ship spun and Gateway drifted diagonally down across the view screen, lumpy, pear-shaped blob of charcoal and blue glitter. The four of us just sat there and waited. Nearly an hour it took until we felt the grinding jar that meant we had docked. Clara sighed. Ham slowly began to unstrap himself from his sling. Dredd stared absorbedly at the view screen, although it was not showing anything more interesting than Sirius and Orion. It occurred to me, looking at the three others in the capsule, that we were going to be as unpleasant a sight to the boarding crews as some of the scarier returnees had been for me in that long-ago previous time when I had been a fresh fish on Gateway. I touched my nose tenderly. It hurt a great deal, and above all it stank, internally right next to my own sense of smell, where there was no way I could get away from it. We heard the hatches open as the boarding crew entered, and then heard their startled voices in two or three languages as they saw Sam Cahane where we had put him in the lander. Clara stirred. Might as well get off, she murmured to no one, and started toward the hatch, now overhead again. One of the cruiser crew stuck his head through the hatch and said, Oh, you're all still alive. We were wondering. Then he looked at us more closely and didn't say anything else. It had been a wearing trip, especially the last 2 weeks. We climbed out, one by one, past where Sam Cahane still hung in the improvised straitjacket Dredd had made for him out of his spacesuit top, surrounded by his own excrement and litter of food, staring at us out of his calm, mad eyes. Two of the crewmen were untying him and getting ready to lift him out of the lander. He didn't say anything, and that was a blessing. Hello, Bob, Clara. It was the Brazilian member of the detail who turned out to be Francie Herrera. Looks like a bad one? Oh, I said, at least we came back. But Cahane's in bad shape, and we came up empty. He nodded sympathetically and said something in what I took to be Spanish to the Venusian member of the detail, a short, plump woman with dark eyes. She tapped me on the shoulder and led me away to a little cubicle where she signaled me to take off my clothes. I had always thought that they'd have men searching men and women searching women, but come to think of it, it didn't seem to matter much. She went over every stitch I owned, both visually and with a radiation counter, then examined my armpits and poked something into my anus. She opened her mouth wide to signal I should open mine, peered inside, and then drew back, covering her face with her hand. "Your nose stink very much," she said. "What happened to you?" "I got hit," I said. "That other fellow, Sam Cahane, he went crazy, wanted to change the settings." She nodded doubtfully and peered up my nose at the packed gauze. She touched the nostril gently with one finger. "What?" "In there. We had to pack it. It was hemorrhaging a lot." She sighed. "I should pull it out." She meditated and then shrugged. "No. Put clothes on. All right." So I got dressed again and went out into the lander chamber, but that wasn't the end of it. I had to be debriefed. All of us did, except Sam. They had already taken him away to Terminal Hospital. You wouldn't think there was much for us to tell anybody about our trip. All of it had been fully documented as we went along. That was what all the readings and observations were for. But that wasn't the way the corporation worked. They pumped us for every fact and every recollection, and then for every subjective impression and fleeting suspicion. The debriefing went on for 2 solid hours, and we all were careful to give them everything they asked. That's another way the corporation has you. The evaluation board can decide to give you a bonus for anything at all. Anything from noticing something nobody has noticed before about the way the spiral gadget lights up to figuring out a way of disposing of used sanitary tampons without flushing them down the toilet. The story is that they try hard to find some excuse to throw a tip to crews that have had a hard time without coming up with a real find. Well, that was us, all right. We wanted to give them every chance we could for a handout. One of our debriefers was Dane Metchnikoff, which surprised me and even pleased me a little. Back in the far less foul air of Gateway, I was beginning to feel a little more human. He had come up empty, too, emerging into orbit around a sun that had apparently gone nova within the previous 50,000 years or so. Maybe there had been a planet once, but now it only existed in the memory of the Heechee course-setting machines. There wasn't enough left to justify a science bonus, so he had turned around and come back. "I'm surprised to see you working," I said during a lull. He didn't take offense, for Metchnikoff, surly creature that he had always been, he seemed strangely cheerful. "It isn't the money. You learn something doing this." "About what?" "About how to beat the odds, Broadhead. I'm going out again, but this time I'm going to have a little more of an edge. There's a new wrinkle." Dredd, sitting next to me with his own interviewer, perked up and leaned over. "Tell us." Metchnikoff looked wary. "It's better readings on the spectrum lines," he said vaguely. "Now, what about the rations? You say some of the food tasted funny toward the end?" But before I left, I made him promise to tell me what he meant. "I'll call you," he said to Clara and me, "maybe tomorrow." And so the two of us went home. A note on dwarfs and giants. Dr. Asminian, you all ought to know what a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram looks like. If you find yourself in a globular cluster or anywhere where there's a compact mass of stars, it's worth plotting an HR for that group. Also, keep your eye out for unusual spectral classes. You won't get a nickel for Fs, Gs, or Ks. We've got all the readings on them you could want. But if you happen to find yourself orbiting a white dwarf or a very late red giant, make all the tape you've got. Also, Os and Bs are worth investigating, even if they're not your primary. But if you happen to be in close orbit in an armored 5 around a good bright O, that ought to be worth a couple hundred thousand at least, if you bring back the data. Question, why? Dr. Asminian, what? Question, why do we only get the bonus if we're in an armored 5? Dr. Asminian, oh, because if you aren't, you won't come back. End a note on dwarfs and giants. Chapter 19. I'm feeling so powerful and so scared that I don't know how to deal with it. On a slip of paper, S. Yaw has written out the command words that will turn Siegfried von Schrenk, the remorseless pursuer, into a tabby cat. I don't have to look at the words. I know them by heart. Nevertheless, I read them slowly and carefully. Pay attention, Siegfried. This is an override command. Category Alpha Alpha Margaret Truman Daniel Mercury Venus Mars Earth 6606. You are commanded to assume passive display mode. I look at him. Nothing happens. Siegfried, did I say it right? Do you accept the command? Of course, Bob. His voice is exactly the same as it was before, which shakes me. I don't know what I expected. I just don't know. Maybe my fantasy was that the father figure hologram would disappear and a cathode tube display would suddenly light up to spell out, Roger Wilco, I am your slave. I find myself trembling. I don't analyze what that is from. It feels almost sexual. I say, well, Siegfried, old bucket of bolts, does this mean I have you in my power? The father figure says patiently, it means you can command me, Bob. The command function is, of course, limited to display. I frown. Meaning what? You cannot change my basic programming. For that, you would need a different command. All right, I say. Ha! Here's your first instruction. Display that different command for me. I can't, Bob. You must, mustn't you? I am not refusing your order, Bob. I simply do not know what that other command is. Bullshit, I yell. How can you respond to it if you don't know what it is? I just do, Bob. Or, always fatherly, always patient, to answer you more fully, each bit of the command actuates a sequenced instruction, which, when completed, releases another area of command. In technical terms, each key socket intermatching go to's another socket, which the following bit keys. Shit, I say. I stew over that for a moment. Then what is it that I actually can control, Siegfried? You can direct me to display any information stored. You can direct me to display it in any mode within my capabilities. Any mode? I look at my watch and realize with annoyance that there is a time limit on this game. I only have about 10 minutes left of my appointment. Do you mean that I could make you talk to me, for instance, in French? Oui, Robert, d'accord. Que voulez-vous? Or in Russian with a... Wait a minute. I'm experimenting pretty much at random. I mean like in the voice of a basso profundo from the Bolshoi opera? Tones that came out of the bottom of a cave. Da, gospodin. And you'll tell me anything I want to know about me? Da, gospodin. In English, damn it. Yes. Or about your other clients? Yes. That sounds like fun. And just who are these lucky other clients, dear Siegfried? Run down the list. I can hear my own prurience leaking out of my voice. Monday, 900, he begins obligingly. Jan Ilaveski, 1000, Mario Laterani, 1100, Julie Loudon Martin, 12... Her? I say. Tell me about her. Julie Loudon Martin is a referral from Kings County General, where she was an outpatient after 6 months of treatment with aversion therapy and immune response activators for alcoholism. She has a history of two apparent suicide attempts following postpartum depression 53 years ago. She has been in therapy with me for... Wait a minute, I say, having added the probable age of childbearing to 53 years. I'm not so sure I'm interested in Julie. Can you give me an idea of what she looks like? I can display hollow views, Bob. So do it. At once there is a quick subliminal flash and a blur of color, and then I see this tiny black lady lying on a mat, my mat, in a corner of the room. She's talking slowly and without much interest to no one perceptible. I cannot hear what she is saying, but then I don't much want to. Go on, I say, and when you name your patients, show me what they look like. 1200, Lauren Schofield. Old man with arthritic fingers bent into claws holding his head. 1300, Francis Astrit. Young girl, not even pubescent. 1400, I let him go on for a while all through Monday and halfway through Tuesday. I had not realized he kept such long hours, but then, of course, being a machine, he doesn't really get tired. One or two of the patients look interesting, but there is no one I know, or no one that looks more worth knowing than Yvette, Donna, S. Yaw, or about a dozen others. You can stop that now, I say, and think for a minute. This isn't really as much fun as I thought it was going to be. Plus, my time is running out. I guess I can play this game any old time, I say. Right now, let's talk about me. What would you like me to display, Bob? What you usually keep from me. Diagnosis, prognosis, general comments on my case. What kind of a guy you think I am, really? The subject, Robinette Stetley Broadhead, he says at once, exhibits moderate depression symptoms, well compensated by an active lifestyle. His reason for seeking psychiatric help is given as depression and disorientation. He has pronounced guilt feelings and exhibits selective aphasia on the conscious level about several episodes that recur as dream symbols. His sexual drive is relatively low. His relationships with women are generally unsatisfactory, although his psychosexual orientation is predominantly heterosexual in the 80th percentile. The hell you say? I begin on a delayed reaction to low sexual drive and unsatisfactory relationships. But I don't really feel like arguing with him. And anyway, he says voluntarily at that point, I must inform you, Bob, that your time is nearly up. You should go to the recovery room now. Crap. What have I got to recover from? But his point is well taken. All right, I say. Go back to normal. Cancel the command. Is that all I have to say? Is it canceled? Yes, Robbie. You're doing it again, I yell. Make up your fucking mind what you're going to call me. I address you by the term appropriate to your state of mind, or to the state of mind I wish to induce in you, Robbie. And now you want me to be a baby? No, never mind that. Listen, I say, getting up. Do you remember all our conversation while I had you commanded to display? Certainly I do, Robbie. And then he adds on his own a full surprising 10 or 20 seconds after my time is up. Are you satisfied, Robbie? What? Have you established to your own satisfaction that I am only a machine, that you can control me at any time? I stop short. Is that what I'm doing? I demand, surprised, and then, all right, I guess so. You're a machine, Siegfried. I can control you. And he says after me as I leave, we always knew that really, didn't we? The real thing you fear, the place where you feel control is needed, isn't that in you? Classifieds. Painless dentistry. Private fee basis. Completely equipped. All needs. References. 87-579. Non-smoker. Uptights in your crew. I'm exclusive gateway agent for smoke suppressor cigarette smoking hood. Gives you all the fun. Spares your crewmates the smog. Phone 87-196 for demonstration. End classifieds. Chapter 20. When you spend weeks on end close to another person, so close that you know every hiccup, every smell, and every scratch on the skin, you either come out of it hating each other or so deep in each other's gut that you can't find a way out. Claire and I were both. Our little love affair had turned into a Siamese twin relationship. There wasn't any romance in it. There wasn't room enough between us for romance to occur. And yet, I knew every inch of Clara, every pore and every thought, far better than I'd known my own mother. And in the same way, from the womb out, I was surrounded by Clara. And like a Klein bottle yin and yang, she was surrounded by me, too. We each defined the other's universe, and there were times when I, and I am sure she, was desperate to break out and breathe free air again. The first day we got back, filthy and exhausted, we automatically headed for Clara's place. That was where the private bath was. There was plenty of room. It was all ready for us, and we fell into bed together, like old marrieds, after a week of backpacking. Only we weren't old marrieds. I had no claim on her. At breakfast the next morning, earth-born Canadian bacon and eggs, scandalously expensive, fresh pineapple, cereal with real cream, cappuccino. Clara made sure to remind me of that fact by ostentatiously paying for it on her own credit. I exhibited the Pavlovian reflex she wanted. I said, you don't have to do that. I know you have more money than I do. And you wish you knew how much, she said, smiling sweetly. Actually, I did know. Shiki had told me. She had $700,000 and change in her account, enough to go back to Venus and live the rest of her life there in reasonable security if she wanted to. Although, why anyone would want to live on Venus in the first place, I can't say. Maybe that was why she stayed on Gateway when she didn't have to. One tunnel is much like another. You really ought to let yourself be born. I said, finishing out the thought aloud. You can't stay in the womb forever. She was surprised, but game. Bob, dear, she said, fishing a cigarette out of my pocket and allowing me to light it, you really ought to let your poor mother be dead. It's just so much trouble for me trying to remember to keep rejecting you so you can court her through me. I perceived that we were talking at cross purposes, but on the other hand, I perceived that we really weren't. The actual agenda was not to communicate, but to draw blood. Clara, I said kindly, you know that I love you. It worries me that you've reached 40 without really ever having had a good, long, lasting relationship with a man. She giggled. Honey, she said, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. That nose, she made a face. Last night in bed, tired as I was, I thought I might upchuck until you turned the other way. Maybe if you went down to the hospital, they could unpack it. Well, I could even smell it myself. I don't know what it is about stale surgical packing, but it is pretty hard to take. So I promised I would do that. And then to punish her, I didn't finish the $100 order of fresh pineapple. And so to punish me, she irritably began shifting my belongings around in her cupboards to make room for the contents of her knapsack. So naturally I had to say, don't do that, dear. Much as I love you, I think I'd better move back to my own room for a while. She reached over and patted my arm. It will be pretty lonely, she said, stubbing out the cigarette. I've got pretty used to waking up next to you. On the other hand, I'll pick up my stuff on the way back from the hospital, I said. I wasn't enjoying the conversation that much. I didn't want to prolong it. It is the sort of man-to-woman infight that I try, whenever possible, to ascribe to premenstrual tension. I like the theory, but unfortunately, in this case, I happen to know that it didn't account for Clara. And, of course, it leaves unresolved at any time the question of how to account for me. At the hospital, they kept me waiting for more than an hour, and then they hurt me a lot. I bled like a stuck pig all over my shirt and pants, and while they were reeling out of my nose those endless yards of cotton gauze that Ham Taya had stuffed there to keep me from bleeding to death, it felt exactly as if they were pulling out huge gobbets of flesh. I yelled. The little old Japanese lady who was working as outpatient paramedic that day gave me scant patience. Oh, shut up, please, she said. You sound like that crazy returnee who killed himself. Scream for an hour. I waved her away, one hand to my nose to stop the blood. Alarm bells were going off. What was his name? She pushed my hand away and dabbed at my nose. I don't know. Oh, wait a minute. You were from that same hard luck ship, weren't you? That's what I'm trying to find out. Was it Sam Kahane? She became suddenly more human. I'm sorry, sweet, she said. I guess that was the name. They went to give him a shot to keep him quiet, and he got the needle away from the doctor, and, well, he stabbed himself to death. It was a real bummer of a day, all right. In the long run, she got me cauterized. I'm going to put in just a little packing, she said. Tomorrow you can take it out yourself. Just be slow about it, and if you hemorrhage, get your ass down here in a hurry. She let me go, looking like an axe murder victim. I skulked up to Clara's room to change my clothes, and the day went on, being rotten. Fucking Gemini, she snarled at me. Next time I go out, it's going to be with a Taurian like that fellow Metchnikoff. What's the matter, Clara? They gave us a bonus, $12,005. Christ, I tipped my maid more than that. How do you know? I had already divided $12,500 by five, and in the same split second wondered whether under the circumstances they wouldn't divide it by four instead. They called on the P-phone 10 minutes ago. Jesus, the rottenest son of a bitch and trip I've ever been on, and I wind up with the price of one green chip at the casino out of it. Then she looked at my shirt and softened a little. Well, it's not your fault, Bob. The Geminis never can make up their minds. I should have known that. Let me see if I can find you some clean clothes. And I did let her do that, but I didn't stay anyway. I picked up my stuff, headed for a drop shaft, cashed my goods at the registry office where I signed up to get my room back, and borrowed the use of their phone. When she mentioned Metchnikoff's name, she had reminded me of something I wanted to do. Metchnikoff grumbled, but finally agreed to meet me in the schoolroom. I was there before him, of course. He loped in, stopped at the doorway, looked around, and said, "Where's what's her name?" "Clara Moynlin. She's in our room. Neat, truthful, deceitful, a model answer. Hmm. He ran an index finger down each jaw whisker meeting under the chin. Come on, then. Leading me, he said over his shoulder. Actually, she would probably get more out of this than you would. I suppose she would, Dane. Hmm. He hesitated at the bump in the floor that was the entrance to one of the instruction ships, then shrugged, opened the hatch, and clambered down inside. He was being unusually open and generous, I thought as I followed him inside. He was already crouched in front of the course selector panel, setting up numbers. He was holding a portable hand readout data linked to the corporation's master computer system. I knew that he was punching in one of the established settings, and so I was not surprised when he got color almost at once. He thumbed the fine tuner and waited, looking over his shoulder at me until the whole board was drowned in shocking pink. All right, he said. Good, clear setting. Now, look at the bottom part of the spectrum. That was the smaller line of rainbow colors along the right side of the board, red to violet. The violet was on the bottom, and the colors merged into one another without break, except for occasional lines of bright color or black. They looked exactly like what the astronomers called Fraunhofer lines, when the only way they had to know what a star or planet was made of was to study it through a spectroscope. They weren't. Fraunhofer lines show what elements are present in a radiation source, or in something that has gotten itself between the radiation source and you. These showed God knows what. God and maybe Dane Metchnikoff, he was almost smiling and astonishingly talkative. That band of three dark lines in the blue, he said, see, they seem to relate to the hazardousness of the mission. At least the computer printouts show that when there are six or more bands there, the ships don't come back. He had my full attention. Christ, I said, thinking of a lot of good people who had died because they hadn't known that. Why don't they tell us these things in school? He said, patiently, for him, Broadhead, don't be a jerk. All this is brand new, and a lot of it is guesswork. Now, the correlation between number of lines and danger isn't quite so good under six. I mean, if you think that they might add one line for every additional degree of danger, you're wrong. You would expect that the five-band settings would have heavy loss ratios, and when there are no bands at all, there wouldn't be any losses. Only it isn't true. The best safety record seems to be with one or two bands. Three is good, too, but there have been some losses. Zero bands, we've had about as many as with three. For the first time, I began to think that the corporation's science research people might be worth their pay. So why don't we just go out on destination settings that are safer? We're not really sure they are safer, Metchnikoff said again, patiently for him. His tone was far more peremptory than his words. Also, when you have an armored ship, you should be able to deal with more risks than the plain ones. Quit with the dumb questions, Broadhead. Sorry. I was getting uncomfortable, crouched behind him and peering over his shoulder, so that when he turned to look at me, his jaw whiskers almost grazed my nose. I didn't want to change position. So look up here in the yellow, he pointed to five bright bands. This reading seems to correlate with the success of the mission. God knows what we're measuring, or what the Heechee were measuring, but in terms of financial rewards to the crews, there's a pretty good correlation between the number of lines in that frequency and the amount of money the crews get. Wow, he went on as though I hadn't said anything. Now, naturally, the Heechee didn't set up a meter to calibrate how much in royalties you or I might make. It has to be measuring something else. Who knows what? Maybe it's a measure of population density in that area, or of technological development. Maybe it's a guide Michelin, and all they're saying is that there was a four-star restaurant in that area. But there it is. Five-bar yellow expeditions bring in a financial return on the average that's 50 times as high as two-bar and 10 times as high as most of the others. He turned around again so that his face was maybe a dozen centimeters from mine, his eyes staring right into my eyes. You want to see some other settings? He asked in a tone of voice that demanded I say no, so I did. Okay, and then he stopped. I stood up and backed away to get a little more space. One question, Dane. You probably have a reason for telling me all this before it gets to be public information. What is it? Right, he said. I want what's-her-name for crew if I go in a three or a five. Clara Moynlin? Whatever. She handles herself well, doesn't take up much room, knows how to get along with people better than I do. I sometimes have difficulty in interpersonal relationships, he explained. Of course, that's only if I take a 3 or a 5. I don't particularly want to. If I can find a 1, that's what I'm going to take out. But if there isn't a 1 with a good setting available, I want somebody along I can rely on, who won't get in my hair, who knows the ropes, can handle the ship, all that. You can come too, if you want. When I got back to my own room, Shiki turned up almost before I started to unpack. He was glad to see me. I'm sorry your trip was unfruitful, he said, out of his endless stock of gentleness and warmth. It is too bad about your friend Kahane. He had brought me a flask of tea and then perched on the chest across from my hammock, just like the first time. The disastrous trip was almost out of my mind, which was filled with visions of sugar plums coming out of my talk with Dane Metchnikoff. I couldn't help talking about it. I told Shiki everything Dane had said. He listened like a child to a fairy tale, his black eyes shining. How interesting, he said. I had heard rumors that there was to be a new briefing for everyone. Just think, if we can go out without fear of death or... He hesitated, fluttering his wing gauze. It isn't that sure, Shiki, I said. No, of course not. But it is an improvement. I think you will agree. He hesitated, watching me take a pull from the flask of almost flavorless Japanese tea. Bob, he said, if you go on such a trip and need an extra man... Well, it is true that I would not be of much use in a lander, but in orbit, I am as good as anybody. I know you are, Shiki, I tried to put it tactfully. Does the corporation know that? They would accept me as crew on a mission no one else wanted. I see. I didn't say that I didn't really want to go on a mission no one else wanted. Shiki knew that. He was one of the real old-timers on Gateway. According to the rumor, he had had a big wad stashed away, enough for full medical and everything. But he had given it away, or lost it, and stayed on, and stayed a cripple. I know that he understood what I was thinking, but I was a long way from understanding Shikati Bakin. He moved out of my way while I stowed my things, and we gossiped about mutual friends. Sherry's ship had not returned. Nothing to worry about yet, of course. It could easily be out another several weeks without disaster. A Congolese couple from just beyond the star point in the corridor had brought back a huge shipment of prayer fans from a previously unknown Hichi 1 on a planet around an F2 star in the end of the Orion spiral arm. They had split $1 million 3 ways and had taken their share back to Mungberry. The Forehands, Louise Forehand stopped in while we were talking about them, heard your voices, she said, craning over to kiss me. Too bad about your trip. Breaks of the game. Well, welcome home anyway. I didn't do any better than you, I'm afraid. Dumb little star. No planets that we could find. Can't think why in the world the Hichi had a course setting for it. She smiled and stroked the muscles at the back of my neck fondly. Can I give you a welcome home party tonight? Or are you and Clara? I'd love it if you did, I said, and she didn't pursue the question of Clara. No doubt the rumor had already got around. The Gateway tom-toms beat day and night. She left after a few minutes. Nice lady, I said to Shiki, looking after her. Nice family. Was she looking a little worried? I fear so, Robinette, yes. Her daughter Lois is on plus time. They have had much sorrow in that family. I looked at him. He said, no, not Willa or the father. They are out, but not overdue. There was a son. I know. Henry, I think. They called him Hat. He died just before they came here. And now Lois... He inclined his head, then flapped politely over and picked up the empty tea flask on a downstroke of his wing. I must go to work now, Bob. How's the ivy planting? He said ruefully, I no longer have that position, I'm afraid. Emma did not consider me executive material. Oh, what are you doing? I keep Gateway aesthetically attractive, he said. I think you would call it garbage collector. I didn't know what to say. Gateway was kind of a trashy place. Because of the low gravity, any scrap of paper or bit of featherweight plastic that was thrown away was likely to float anywhere inside the asteroid. You couldn't sweep the floor. The first stroke set everything flying. I had seen the garbage men chasing scraps of newsprint and fluffs of cigarette ash with little hand-pumped vacuum cleaners, and I had even thought about becoming one if I had to, but I didn't like Shiki doing it. He was following what I was thinking about him without difficulty. It's all right, Bob. Really, I enjoy the work, but please, if you do need a crewman, think of me. A note on blow-ups. Dr. Esminian. Naturally, if you can get good readings on a nova, or especially on a supernova, that's worth a lot. While it's happening, I mean. Later, not much good. And always look for our own sun. And if you can identify it, take all the tape you can get, at all frequencies, around the immediate area, up to, oh, about 5 degrees each way, anyway, with maximum magnification. Question, why is that, Danny? Dr. Esminian, well, maybe you'll be on the far side of the sun from something like Tycho's star or the Crab Nebula, which is what's left of the 1054 supernova in Taurus. And maybe you'll get a picture of what the star looked like before it blew. That ought to be worth, gee, I don't know, 50 or 100,000 right there. End of a note on blow-ups. I took my bonus and paid up my per capita for 3 weeks in advance. I bought a few items I needed, new clothes and some music tapes to get the sound of Mozart and Palestrina out of my ears. That left me about $200 in money. $200 was a lot like nothing at all. It meant 20 drinks at the Blue Hell, or one chip at the blackjack table, or maybe half a dozen decent meals outside the prospector's commissary. So I had three choices. I could get another job, install indefinitely, or I could ship out within the 3 weeks, or I could give up and go home. None of the choices was attractive. But provided I didn't spend any money on anything much, I didn't have to decide for, a long time, as long as 20 days. I resolved to give up smoking and bought meals. That way I could budget myself to a maximum spending of $9 a day, so that my per capita and my cash would run out at the same time. I called Clara. She looked and sounded guarded, but friendly on the P-phone, so I spoke guardedly and amiably to her. I didn't mention the party, and she didn't mention wanting to see me that night, so we left it at that, nowhere. That was all right with me. I didn't need Clara. At the party that night, I met a new girl around called Doreen McKenzie. She wasn't a girl, really. She was at least a dozen years older than I was, and she had been out 5 times. What was exciting about her was that she had really hit it once. She'd taken 1.5 mil back to Atlanta, spent the whole wad trying to buy herself a career as a PV singer, material writer, manager, publicity team, advertising, demo tapes, the works. And when it hadn't worked, she had come back to Gateway to try again. The other thing was, she was very, very pretty. But after 2 days of getting to know Doreen, I was back on the P-phone to Clara. She said, come on down. And she sounded anxious, and I was there in 10 minutes, and we were in bed in 15. The trouble with getting to know Doreen was that I had got to know her. She was nice, and a hell of a racing pilot. But she wasn't Clara Moynlin. When we were lying in the hammock together, sweaty and relaxed and spent, Clara yawned, ruffled my hair, pulled back her head, and stared at me. Oh, shit, she said drowsily. I think this is what they call being in love. I was gallant. It's what makes the world go around. No, not it. You are. She shook her head regretfully. Sometimes I can't stand you, she said. Sagittarians never make it with Geminis. I'm a fire sign, and you, well, Geminis can't help being confused. I wish you wouldn't keep going on about that crap, I said. She didn't take offense. Let's get something to eat. I slid over the edge of the hammock and stood up, needing to talk without touching for a moment. Dear Clara, I said, look, I can't let you keep me because you'll be bitchy about it sooner or later. Or if you aren't, I'll be expecting you to. And so I'll be bitchy to you. And I just don't have the money. If you want to eat outside the commissary, you do it by yourself. And I won't take your cigarettes, your liquor, or your chips at the casino. So if you want to get something to eat, go ahead. And I'll meet you later. Maybe we could go for a walk. She sighed. Geminis never know how to handle money, she told me, but they can be awfully nice in bed. We put our clothes on and went out and got something to eat, all right, but in the corporation commissary, where you stand in line, carry a tray, and eat standing up. The food isn't bad, if you don't think too much about what substrates they grow it on. The price is right. It doesn't cost anything. They promise that if you eat all your meals in a commissary, you will have 100+% of all the established dietary needs. You will, too, only you have to eat all of everything to be sure of that. Single-cell protein and vegetable protein come out incomplete when considered independently, so it's not enough to eat the soybean jelly or the bacterial pudding alone. You have to eat them both. The other thing about corporation meals is that they produce a hell of a lot of methane, which produces a hell of a lot of what all ex-Gateway types remember as the Gateway Fug. We drifted down toward the lower levels afterward, not talking much. I suppose we were both wondering where we were going. I don't mean just at that moment. Feel like exploring? Clara asked. I took her hand as we strolled along, considering. That sort of thing was fun. Some of the old ivy-choked tunnels that no one used were interesting, and beyond them were the bare, dusty places that no one had troubled even to plant ivy in. Usually there was plenty of light from the ancient walls themselves, still glowing with that bluish, heachy metal sheen. Sometimes, not lately, but no more than 6 or 7 years ago, people had actually found heachy artifacts in them, and you never knew when you might stumble on something worth a bonus. But I couldn't work up much enthusiasm for it, because nothing is fun when you don't have a choice. Why not? I said. But a few minutes later, when I saw where we were, I said, let's go to the museum for a while. Oh, right, she said, suddenly interested. Did you know they've fixed up the surround room? Metchnikoff was telling me about it. They opened it while we were out. So we changed course, dropped 2 levels, and came out next to the museum. The surround room was a nearly spherical chamber just beyond it. It was big, 10 meters or more across, and in order to use it, we had to strap on wings like shikis hanging on a rack outside the entrance. Neither Clara nor I had ever used them before, but it wasn't hard. On Gateway, you weigh so little to begin with that flying would be the easiest and best way to get around if there were any places inside the asteroid big enough to fly in. So we dropped through the hatch into the sphere and were in the middle of a whole universe. The chamber was walled with hexagonal panels, each one of them projected from some source we could not see, probably digital with liquid crystal screens. How pretty! Clara cried. All around us, there was a sort of globorama of what the scouting ships had found. Stars, nebulae, planets, satellites. Sometimes each plate showed its own independent thing, so that there were, what was it, something like 128 separate scenes. Then, flick, all of them changed. Flick again, and they began to cycle, some of them holding their same scene, some of them changing to something new. Flick again, and one whole hemisphere lit up with a mosaic view of the M31 galaxy as seen from God knew where. Hey, I said, really excited, this is great. And it was. It was like being on all the trips any prospector had ever taken without the drudgery and the trouble and the constant fear. There was no one there but us, and I couldn't understand why it was so pretty. You would think there would be a long line of people waiting to get in. One side began to run through a series of pictures of Heechee artifacts, as discovered by prospectors. Prayer fans of all colors, wall lining machines, the insides of Heechee ships, some tunnels. Clara cried out that they were places she had been, back home on Venus, but I don't know how she could tell. Then the pattern went back to photographs from space. Some of them were familiar. I could recognize the Pleiades in one quick 6 or 8 panel shot, which vanished and was replaced by a view of Gateway 2 from outside, 2 of the bright young stars of the cluster shining in reflection off its sides. I saw something that might have been the Horsehead Nebula, and a donut-shaped puff of gas and dust that was either the Ring Nebula in Lyra or what an exploring team had found a few orbits before and called the French Cruller in the skies of a planet where Heechee digs had been detected but not reached under a frozen sea. We hung there for half an hour or so until it began to look as though we were seeing the same things again, and then we fluttered up to the hatch, hung up the wings, and sat down for a cigarette break in a wide place in the tunnel outside the museum. 2 women I recognized vaguely as corporation maintenance crews came by carrying rolled-up strap-on wings. Hi, Clara, one of them greeted her. Been inside? Clara nodded. It was beautiful, she said. Enjoy it while you can, said the other one. Next week it'll cost you $100. We're putting in a P-phone tape lecture system tomorrow, and they'll have the grand opening before the next tourists show up. It's worth it, Claire said, but then she looked at me. I became aware that in spite of everything, I was smoking one of her cigarettes. At $5 a pack, I couldn't afford very much of that, but I made up my mind to buy at least one pack out of that day's allowance and to make sure she took as many from me as I took from her. Want to walk some more? She asked. Maybe a little later, I said. I was wondering how many men and women had died to take the pretty pictures we had been watching, because I was facing one more time the fact that sooner or later I would have to submit myself again to the lethal lottery of the Heechee ships, or give up. I wondered if the new information Metchnikoff had given me was going to make a real difference. Everyone was talking about it now. The corporation had scheduled an all-phone announcement for the next day. That reminds me, I said. Did you say you'd seen Metchnikoff? I wondered when you'd ask me about that, she said. Sure. He called and told me he'd shown the color-coding stuff to you. So I went down and got the same lecture. What do you think, Bob? I stubbed out the cigarette. I think everybody in Gateway is going to be fighting for the good launches. That's what I think. But maybe Dane knows something. He's been working with the corporation. I don't doubt he does. I stretched and leaned back, rocking against the low gravity, considering. He's not that nice a guy, Clara. Maybe he'd tell us if there's something good coming up, you know, that he knows something special about. But he'll want something for it. Clara grinned. He'd tell me. What do you mean? Oh, he calls me once in a while. Wants a date. Oh, shit, Clara. I was feeling pretty irritated by then. Not just at Clara, and not just about Dane. About money. About the fact that if I wanted to go back into the surround room next week, it would cost me half my credit balance. About the dark, shadowed image looming up ahead in time, and not very far ahead, when I would once again have to make up my mind to do what I was scared silly to do again. I wouldn't trust that son of a bitch as far as... No, relax, Bob. He's not such a bad guy, she said, lighting another cigarette and leaving the pack where I could reach it if I wanted it. Sexually, he might be kind of interesting, that raw, rough, rude Taurian thing. Anyway, you've got as much to offer him as I do. What are you talking about? She looked honestly surprised. I thought you knew. He swings both ways. He's never given me any indication... But I stopped, remembering how close he liked to get when he was talking to me, and how uncomfortable I was with him inside my body space. Maybe you're not his type, she grinned, only it wasn't a kindly grin. A couple of Chinese crewmen coming out of the museum looked at us with interest, and then politely looked away. Let's get out of here, Clara. So we went to the Blue Hell, and of course I insisted on paying my share of the drinks, $48 down the tube in 1 hour, and it wasn't all that much fun. We wound up in her place, in bed again. That wasn't all that much fun either. The quarrel was still there when we finished, and the time was slipping by. The Gateway Anglican. The Reverend Theo Durley, Chaplain. Parish Communion, 10:30 Sundays. Evensong, by arrangement. Eric Manier, who ceased to be my warden on 1 December, has left an indelible mark on Gateway All Saints, and we owe him an incalculable debt for placing his multi-competence at our disposal. Born in Elstree, Hertfordshire, 51 years ago, he graduated as Bachelor of Law from the University of London and then read for the bar. Subsequently, he was employed for some years in Perth at the Natural Gas Works. If we are saddened for ourselves that he is leaving us, it is tempered with joy that he has now achieved his heart's desire and will return to his beloved Hertfordshire, where he expects to devote his retirement years to civic affairs, transcendental meditation, and the study of plain song. A new warden will be elected the first Sunday we attain a quorum of 9 parishioners. End the Gateway Anglican. There are people who never pass a certain point in their emotional development. They cannot live a normal, free, and easy give-and-take life with a sexual partner for more than a short time. Something inside them will not tolerate happiness. The better it gets, the more they have to destroy it. Hacking around Gateway with Clara, I began to suspect that I was one of those people. I knew Clara was. She had never sustained a relationship with a man for more than a few months in her life. She told me so herself. Already I was pretty close to a record with her, and already it was making her edgy. In some ways, Clara was a lot more adult and responsible than I ever would be. The way she got to Gateway in the first place, for instance. She didn't win a lottery to pay her fare. She earned it, and saved it, painfully, over a period of years. She was a fully qualified air body driver, with a guide's license and engineering degree. She had lived like a fish farmer while earning an income that would have entitled her to a three-room flat in the Heechee Warrens on Venus, vacations on Earth, and major medical. She knew more than I did about the growing of food on hydrocarbon substrates, in spite of all my years in Wyoming. She had invested in a food factory on Venus, and for all her life, she had never put a dollar into anything she didn't fully understand. When we were out together, she was the senior member of the crew. It was she Metchnikoff wanted as a shipmate, if he wanted anybody, not me. She had been my teacher. And yet, between the two of us, she was as inept and unforgiving as ever I had been with Sylvia, or with Dina, Janice, Liz, Esther, or any of the other two-week romances that had all ended badly in all the years after Sylvia. It was, she said, because she was Sagittarius and I was a Gemini. Sagittarians were prophets. Sagittarians loved freedom. Us poor Geminis were just terribly mixed up and indecisive. It's no wonder, she told me gravely one morning, eating breakfast in her room. I accepted no more than a couple of sips of coffee. That you can't make your mind up to go out again. It isn't just physical cowardice, dear Robinette. Part of your twin nature wants to triumph. Part wants to fail. I wonder which side you will allow to win. I gave her an ambiguous answer. I said, honey, go screw yourself. And she laughed, and we got through that day. She had scored her point. The corporation made its expected announcement, and there was an immense flurry of conferring and planning and exchanging guesses and interpretations among all of us. It was an exciting time. Out of the master computer's files, the corporation pulled 20 launches with low danger factors and high profit expectancies. They were subscribed, equipped, and launched within a week. And I wasn't on any of them, and neither was Clara, and we tried not to discuss why. Surprisingly, Dane Metchnikoff didn't go out on any of them. He knew something, or said he did, or didn't say he didn't, when I asked him, just looked at me in that glowering, contemptuous way, and didn't answer. Even Shiki almost went out. He lost out in the last hour before launch, to the Finnish boy who had never been able to find anyone to talk to. There were four Saudis who wanted to stay together and settled for the Finnish kid to fill out a five. Louise Forehand didn't go out either because she was waiting for some member of her family to come back so as to preserve some sort of continuity. You could eat in the corporation commissary now without waiting in line, and there were empty rooms all up and down my tunnel. And one night, Clara said to me, Bob, I think I'm going to go to a shrink. I jumped. It was a surprise. Worse than that, a betrayal. Clara knew about my early psychotic episode and what I thought of psychotherapists. I withheld the first dozen things I thought of to say to her. Tactical, I'm glad. It's about time. Hypocritical, I'm glad, and please tell me how I can help. Strategic, I'm glad, and maybe I ought to go too if I could afford it. I refrained from the only truthful response, which would have been, I interpret this move on your part as a condemnation of me for bending your head. I didn't say anything at all, and after a moment she went on, I need help, Bob. I'm confused. That touched me, and I reached out for her hand. She just let it lay limp in mine, not squeezing back and not pulling away. She said, my psychology professor used to say that was the first step. No, the second step. The first step when you have a problem is to know you have it. Well, I've known that for some time. The second step is to make a decision. Do you want to keep the problem or do you want to do something about it? I've decided to do something about it. Where will you go? I asked, carefully, non-committal. I don't know. The groups don't seem to do much. There's a shrink machine available on the corporation master computer. That would be the cheapest way. Cheap is cheap, I said. I spent 2 years with the shrink machines when I was younger, after I was kind of messed up. And since then, you've been operating for 20 years, she said reasonably. I'd settle for that, for now, anyway. I patted her hand. Any step you take is a good step, I said kindly. I've had the feeling all along that you and I could get along better if you could clear some of that old birthright crap out of your mind. We all do it, I guess, but I'd rather have you angry at me on my own than because I'm acting as a surrogate for your father or something. She rolled over and looked at me. Even in the pale, heachy metal glow, I could see surprise on her face. What are you talking about? Why, your problem, Clara. I know it took a lot of courage for you to admit to yourself that you needed help. Well, Bob, she said, it did, only you don't seem to know what the problem is. Getting along with you isn't the problem. You may be the problem. I just don't know. What I'm worried about is stalling, being unable to make decisions, putting it off so long before I went out again, and, no offense, picking a Gemini like you to go out with. I hate it when you give me that astrology crap. You do have a mixed-up personality, Bob. You know you do. And I seem to lean on that. I don't want to live that way. We were both wide awake again by then, and there seemed to be two ways for things to go. We could get into a, but you said you loved me, but I can't stand this scene, probably ending with either more sex or a wide-open split. Or we could do something to take our minds off it. Clara's thoughts were clearly moving in the same direction as mine, because she slid out of the hammock and began pulling on clothes. Let's go up to the casino, she said brightly. I feel lucky tonight. Mission report. Vessel A3-7, voyage 022D55. Crew S. Rigney, E. Tsien, M. Sindler. Transit time 18 days, 0 hours. Position vicinity Xi Pegasi A. Summary. We emerged in close orbit of a small planet approximately 9 AU from primary. The planet is ice-covered, but we detected Heechee radiation from a spot near the equator. Rigney and Mary Sindler landed nearby, and with some difficulty, the location was mountainous, reached an ice-free warm area within which was a metallic dome. Inside the dome were a number of Heechee artifacts, including two empty landers, home equipment of unknown use, and a heating coil. We succeeded in transporting most of the smaller items to the vessel. It proved impossible to stop the heating coil entirely, but we reduced it to a low level of operation and stored it in the lander for the return. Even so, Mary and Tsien were seriously dehydrated and in coma when we landed. Corporation evaluation. Heating coil analyzed and rebuilt. Award of $3 million made to crew against royalties. Other artifacts not as yet analyzed. Award of $25,000 per kilo mass. Total $675,000 made against future exploitation, if any. End mission report. There weren't any ships in and no tourists. There weren't all that many prospectors either, with so many shiploads going out in the past few weeks. Half the tables at the casino were closed down, with the green cloth hoods over them. Clara found a seat at the blackjack table, signed for a stack of $100 markers, and the dealer let me sit next to her without playing. I told you this was my lucky night, she said, when after 10 minutes she was more than $2,000 ahead of the house. You're doing fine, I encouraged her, but actually it wasn't that much fun for me. I got up and roamed around a little bit. Dane Mechnikov was cautiously feeding $5 coins into the slots, but he didn't seem to want to talk to me. Nobody was playing baccarat. I told Clara I was going to get a cup of coffee at the Blue Hell. $5, but in slow times like this, they would keep filling the cup for nothing. She flashed me a quarter-profile smile without ever taking her eyes off the cards. In the Blue Hell, Louise Forehand was sipping a rocket fuel and water. Well, it wasn't really rocket fuel, just old-fashioned white whiskey made out of whatever happened to be growing well that week in the hydroponics tanks. She looked up with a welcoming smile, and I sat down next to her. She had, it suddenly occurred to me, a rather lonely time of it. No reason she had to. She was, well, I don't know exactly what there was about her, but she seemed like the only non-threatening, non-reproachful, non-demanding person on Gateway. Everybody else either wanted something I didn't want to give or refused to take what I was offering. Louise was something else. She was at least a dozen years older than I and really very good-looking. Like me, she wore only the corporation standard clothes, short coveralls and a choice of three unattractive colors. But she had remade them for herself, converting the jumpsuit into a two-piece outfit with tight shorts, bare midriff, and a loose, open sort of top. I discovered that she was watching me take inventory, and I suddenly felt embarrassed. You're looking good, I said. Thanks, Bob. All original equipment, too, she bragged and smiled. I never could afford anything else. You don't need anything you haven't had all along, I told her sincerely, and she changed the subject. There's a ship coming in, she said. Been a long time out, they say. Well, I knew what that meant to her, and that explained why she was sitting around in the blue hell instead of being asleep at that hour. I knew she was worried about her daughter, but she wasn't letting it paralyze her. She had a very good attitude about prospecting, too. She was afraid of going out, which was sensible, but she didn't let that keep her from going, which I admired a lot. She was still waiting for some other member of her family to return before she signed on again, as they had agreed, so that whoever did come back would always find family waiting. She told me a little more about their background. They had lived, as far as you could call it living, in the tourist traps of the Spindle on Venus, surviving on what they could eke out mostly from the cruise ships. There was a lot of money there, but there was also a lot of competition. The Four Hands had, at one time I discovered, worked up a nightclub act, singing, dancing, comedy routines. I gathered that they were not bad, at least by Venus standards, but the few tourists that were around most of the year had so many other birds of prey battling for a scrap of their flesh that there just wasn't enough to nurture them all. Sess and the son, the one who had died, had tried guiding with an old air body they had managed to buy, wrecked, and rebuild. No big money there. The girls had worked at all kinds of jobs. I was pretty sure that Louise, at least, had been a hooker for a while, but that hadn't paid enough to matter either, for the same sorts of reasons as everything else. They were nearly at the end of their rope when they managed to get to Gateway. It wasn't the first time for them. They'd fought hard to get off Earth in the first place, when Earth got so bad for them that Venus had seemed a less hopeless alternative. They had more courage and more willingness to pull up stakes and go than any other people I'd ever met. "How did you pay for all this travel?" I asked. "Well," said Louise, finishing her drink and looking at her watch, "going to Venus, we traveled the cheapest way there is, high mass load, 220 other immigrants, sleeping in shoulder clamps, lining up for two-minute appointments in the toilets, eating compressed dry rations, and drinking recycled water. It was a hell of a way to spend $40,000 apiece. Fortunately, the kids weren't born yet, except Hat, and he was small enough to go for quarter fare. Hat's your son? What? He died," she said. I waited, but when she spoke again, what she said was, "They should have a radio report from that incoming ship by now. It would have been on the P-phone." She nodded and for a moment looked worried. The corporation always makes routine reports on incoming contacts. If they don't have a contact, well, dead prospectors don't check in by radio. So I took her mind off her troubles by telling her about Clara's decision to see a shrink. She listened and then put her hand over mine and said, "Don't get sore, Bob. Did you ever think of seeing a shrink yourself?" "I don't have the money, Louise." "Not even for a group? There's a primal scream bunch on Level Darling. You can hear them sometimes. And there have been ads for everything. TA, EST, patterning. Of course, a lot of them may have shipped out." But her attention wasn't on me. From where we were sitting, we could see the entrance to the casino, where one of the croupiers was talking interestedly to a crewman from the Chinese cruiser. Louise was staring that way. "Something's going on," I said. I would have added, "Let's go look," but Louise was out of the chair and heading for the casino before me. Play had stopped. Everybody was clustered around the blackjack table, where, I noticed, Dane Mechnikov was now sitting next to Clara in the seat I had vacated, with a couple of $25 chips in front of him. And in the middle of them was Shiki Bakin, perched on a dealer's stool, talking. "No," he was saying as I came up, "I do not know the names, but it's a five." "And they're all still alive?" somebody asked. "As far as I know." "Hello, Bob, Louise." He nodded politely to us both. "I see you've heard." "Not really," Louise said, reaching out unconsciously to hold my hand. "Just that a ship is in. But you don't know the names?" Dane Mechnikov craned his head around to glare at her. "Names," he growled. "Who cares? It's none of us. That's what's important. And it's a big one." He stood up. Even at that moment, I noticed the measure of his anger. He forgot to pick up his chips from the blackjack table. "I'm going down there," he announced. "I want to see what a once-in-a-lifetime score looks like." The cruiser crews had closed off the area, but one of the guards was Francie Herrera. There were 100 people around the drop shaft, and only Herrera and two girls from the American cruiser to keep them back. Mechnikov plunged through to the lip of the shaft, peering down, before one of the girls chased him away. We saw him talking to another five-bracelet prospector. Meanwhile, we could hear snatches of gossip. "Almost dead. They ran out of water." "Nah, just exhausted. They'll be all right. $10 million bonus if it's a nickel. And then the royalties." Clara took Louisa's elbow and pulled her toward the front. I followed in the space they opened. "Does anybody know whose ship it was?" she demanded. Herrera smiled wearily at her, nodded at me, and said, "Not yet, Clara. They're searching them now. I think they're going to be all right, though." Somebody behind me called out. "What did they find?" "Artifacts. New ones. That's all I know." "But it was a five?" Clara asked. Herrera nodded, then peered down the shaft. "All right," he said. "Now, please, back up, friends. They're bringing some of them up now." We all moved microscopically back, but it didn't matter. They weren't getting off at our level anyway. The first one up the cable was a corporation bigwig, whose name I didn't remember, then a Chinese guard, then someone in a terminal hospital robe with a medic on the same grip of the cable, holding him to make sure he didn't fall. I knew the face, but not the name. I had seen him at one of the farewell parties, maybe at several of them, a small, elderly black man who had been out two or three times without scoring. His eyes were open and clear enough, but he looked infinitely fatigued. He looked without astonishment at the crowd around the shaft, and then was out of sight. I looked away and saw that Louise was weeping quietly, her eyes closed. Clara had an arm around her. In the movement of the crowd, I managed to get next to Clara and look a question at her. "It's a five," she said softly. Her daughter was in a three. I knew Louise had heard that, so I patted her and said, "I'm sorry, Louise," and then a space opened at the lip of the shaft and I peered down. I caught a quick glimpse of what $10 or $20 million looked like. It was a stack of hexagonal boxes made out of heechy metal, not more than half a meter across and less than that tall. Then Francie Herrera was coaxing, "Come on, Bob, get back, will you?" And I stepped away from the shaft while another prospector in a hospital robe came up. She didn't see me as she went past. In fact, her eyes were closed, but I saw her. It was Sherry. Chapter 21. "I feel pretty foolish, Siegfried," I say. "Is there some way I can make you feel more comfortable? You can drop dead. He has done his whole room over in nursery school motifs, for Christ's sake. And the worst part is Siegfried himself. He is trying me out with a surrogate mother this time. He's on the mat with me, a big stuffed doll the size of a human being, warm, soft, made out of something like a bath towel stuffed with foam. It feels good, but I guess I don't want you to treat me like a baby," I say, my voice muffled because I'm pressing my face against the toweling. "Just relax, Robbie. It's all right. In a pig's ass, it is." He pauses and then reminds me, "You were going to tell me about your dream." "Yuck. I'm sorry, Robbie. I mean, I don't really want to talk about it. Still," I say quickly, lifting my mouth away from the toweling, "I might as well do what you want. It was about Sylvia, kind of." "Kind of, Robbie?" "Well, she didn't look like herself, exactly. More like, I don't know, someone older, I think. I haven't thought of Sylvia in years, really. We were both kids." "Please go on, Robbie," he says after a moment. I put my arms around him, looking up contentedly enough at the wall of circus poster animals and clowns. It is not in the least like any bedroom I occupied as a child, but Siegfried knows enough about me already. There is no reason for me to tell him that. "The dream, Robbie?" "I dreamed we were working in the mines. It wasn't actually the food mines. It was, physically, I would say more like the inside of a five, one of the gateway ships, you know. Sylvia was in a kind of tunnel that went off it." "The tunnel went off?" "Now, don't rush me into some kind of symbolism, Siegfried. I know about vaginal images and all that. When I say went off, I mean that the tunnel started in the place where I was and led in a direction away from it." I hesitate, then tell him the hard part. "Then her tunnel caved in. Sylvia was trapped." I sit up. "What's wrong with that?" I explain. "Is that really that couldn't happen. You could tunnel in order to plant charges to loosen up the shale. All the real mining is scoop shovel stuff. Sylvia's job would never have put her in that position." "I don't think it matters if it could really have happened, Robbie." "I suppose not. Well, there was Sylvia trapped inside the collapsed tunnel. I could see the heap of shale stirring. It wasn't really shale. It was fluffy stuff, more like scrap paper. She had a shovel, and she was digging her way out. I thought she was going to be all right. She was digging a good escape hole for herself. I waited for her to come out, only she didn't come out." Siegfried, in his incarnation as a teddy bear, lies warm and waiting in my arms. It is good to feel him there. Of course, he isn't really there. He isn't really anywhere except maybe in the central data stores in Washington Heights, where the big machines are kept. All I have is his remote access terminal in a bunny suit. "Is there anything else, Robbie?" "Not really. Not part of the dream, anyway. But Well, I do have a feeling. I feel as though I kicked Claire in the head to keep her from coming out, as though I was afraid the rest of the tunnel was going to fall on me. What do you mean by a feeling, Rob? What I said. It wasn't part of a dream. It was just that I felt... I don't know. He waits. Then he tries a different approach. Bob, are you aware that the name you just said then was Clara, not Sylvia? Really? That's funny. I wonder why. He waits, then he prods a little. Then what happened, Rob? Then I woke up. I roll over on my back and look up at the ceiling, which is textured tile with glittery five-pointed stars pasted to it. That's all there is, I say. Then I add conversationally, Siegfried, I wonder if all this is getting anywhere. I don't know if I can answer that question, Rob. If you could, I say, I would have made you do it before this. I still have S. Yaw's little piece of paper, which gives me a kind of security I prize. I think, he says, that there is somewhere to get. By that I mean, I think there is something in your mind that you don't much want to think of, to which this dream is related. Something about Sylvia, for Christ's sake? That was years ago. That doesn't really matter, does it? Oh, shit, you bore me, Siegfried. You really do. Then I reflect. Say, I'm getting angry. What does that mean? What do you think it means, Rob? If I knew, I wouldn't have to ask you. I wonder, am I trying to cop out, getting angry because you're getting close to something? Please don't think about process, Rob. Just tell me how you feel. Guilty, I say at once without knowing that's what I was going to say. Guilty about what? Guilty about... I'm not sure. I lift my wrist to look at my watch. We've got 20 minutes yet. A hell of a lot can happen in 20 minutes, and I stop to think about whether I want to get really shaken up. I've got a game of duplicate lined up for that afternoon, and I have a good chance to get into the finals, if I don't mess it up, if I keep my concentration. I wonder if I oughtn't to leave early today, Siegfried, I say. Guilty about what, Rob? I'm not sure I remember. I stroke the bunny neck and chuckle. This is really nice, Siegfried, although it took me a while to get used to it. Guilty about what, Rob? I scream. About murdering her, you jerk. You mean in your dream? No, really. Twice. I know I'm breathing hard, and I know Siegfried's sensors are registering it. I fight to get control of myself so he won't get any crazy ideas. I go over what I have just said in my mind to tidy it up. I didn't really murder Sylvia, that is, but I tried, went after her with a knife. Siegfried, calm, reassuring, it says in your case history that you had a knife in your hand when you had a quarrel with your friend. Yes, it doesn't say you went after her. Well, why the hell do you think they put me away? It's just luck I didn't cut her throat. Did you, in fact, use the knife against her at all? Use it? No, I was too mad. I threw it on the floor and got up and punched her. If you were really trying to murder her, wouldn't you have used the knife? Ah, only it is more like yek, the word you sometimes see written as sha. I only wish you'd been there when it happened, Siegfried. Maybe you would have talked them out of putting me away. The whole session is going sour. I know it's always a mistake to tell him about my dreams. He twists them around. I sit up looking with contempt at the crazy furnishings Siegfried has dreamed up for my benefit, and I decide to let him have it straight from the shoulder. Siegfried, I say, as computers go, you're a nice guy, and I enjoy these sessions with you in an intellectual way. But I wonder if we haven't gone about as far as we can go. You're just stirring up old, unnecessary pain, and I frankly don't know why I let you do that to me. Your dreams are full of pain, Bob. So let it stay in my dreams. I don't want to go back to all that same stale kind of crap they used to give me at the Institute. Maybe I do want to go to bed with my mother. Maybe I do hate my father because he died and deserted me. So what? I know that is a rhetorical question, Bob, but the way to deal with these things is to bring them out into the open. For what? To make me hurt? To let the inside hurt come out where you can deal with it. Maybe it would be simpler all around. You know, I just made up my mind to go on hurting a little bit inside. As you say, I'm well compensated, right? I'm not denying that I've got something out of all of this. There are times, Siegfried, when we get through with a session and I really get a lift out of it. I go out of here with my head full of new thoughts, and the sun is bright on the dome, and the air is clean, and everybody seems to be smiling at me, but not lately. Lately, I think it's very boring and unproductive. And what would you say if I told you I wanted to pack it in? I would say that that was your decision to make, Bob. It always is. Well, maybe I'll do that. The old devil outwits me. He knows I'm not going to make that decision, and he is giving me time to realize it for myself. Then he says, Bob, why did you say you murdered her twice? I look at my watch before I answer, and I say, I guess it was just a slip of the tongue. I really do have to go now, Siegfried. I pass up the time in his recovery room because I don't actually have anything to recover from. Besides, I just want to get out of there. Him and his dumb questions. He acts so wise and superior. But what does a teddy bear know? Song. Out in the holes where the Heechee hid, out in the caves of the stars, sliding the tunnels they slashed and slid, healing the Heechee-hacked scars, we're coming through, little lost Heechee, we're looking for you. End song. Chapter 22. I went back to my own room that night, but it took me a long time to get to sleep, and Shiki woke me up early to tell me what was happening. There had been only 3 survivors, and their base award had already been announced, $17,550,000 against royalties. That drove the sleepies out of my eyes. For what? I demanded. Shiki said, for 23 kilograms of artifacts. They think it's a repair kit, possibly for a ship, since that is where they found it, in a lander on the surface of the planet. But at least they are tools of some sort. Tools? I got up, got rid of Shiki, and plodded down the tunnel to the community shower, thinking about tools. Tools could mean a lot. Tools could mean a way to open the drive mechanism in the Heechee ships without blowing up everything around. Tools could mean finding out how the drive worked and building our own. Tools could mean almost anything, and what they certainly meant was a cash award of $17,550,000, not counting royalties, divided 3 ways. One of which could have been mine. It is hard to get a figure like $5,850,000 out of your mind, not to mention royalties, when you think that if you had been a little more foreseeing in your choice of girlfriends, you could have had it in your pocket. Call it $6 million. At my age and health, I could have bought paid-up full medical for less than half of that, which meant all the tests, therapies, tissue replacements, and organ transplants they could cram into me for the rest of my life, which would have been at least 50 years longer than I could expect without it. The other $3 million plus would have bought me a couple of homes, a career as a lecturer, nobody was more in demand than a successful prospector, a steady income for doing commercials on PV, women, food, cars, travel, women, fame, women, and again, there were always the royalties. They could have come to anything at all, depending on what the R&D people managed to do with the tools. Sherry's find was exactly what Gateway was all about, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It took an hour for me to get down to the hospital, 3 tunnel segments and 5 levels in the drop shaft. I kept changing my mind and going back. When I finally managed to purge my mind of envy, or at least to bury it where I didn't think it was going to show, and turned up at the reception desk, Sherry was asleep anyway. You can go in, said the ward nurse. I don't want to wake her up. I don't think you could, he said. Don't force it, of course, but she's allowed visitors. She was in the lowest of 3 bunks in a 12-bed room. 3 or 4 of the others were occupied. 2 of them behind the isolation curtains, milky plastic that you could see through only vaguely. I didn't know who they were. Sherry herself looked quite peacefully, resting one arm under her head, her pretty eyes closed, and her strong, dimpled chin resting on her wrist. Her 2 companions were in the same room, one asleep, one sitting under a holoview of Saturn's rings. I had met him once or twice, a Cuban or Venezuelan or something like that from New Jersey. The only name I could remember for him was Manny. We chatted for a while, and he promised to tell Sherry I had been there. I left and went for a cup of coffee at the commissary, thinking about their trip. They had come out near a tiny cold planet way out from a K6 orange-red cinder of a star, and according to Manny, they hadn't even been sure it was worth the trouble of landing. The readings showed Heechee metal radiation, but not much, and almost all of it, apparently, was buried under carbon dioxide snow. Manny was the one who stayed in orbit. Sherry and the other 3 went down, found a Heechee dig, opened it with great effort, and as usual, found it empty. Then they tracked another trace and found the old lander. They had had to blast to get it open, and in the process, 2 of the prospectors lost integrity of their spacesuits, too close to the blast, I guess. By the time they realized they were in trouble, it was too late for them. They froze. Sherry and the other crewman tried to get them back into their own lander. It must have been pure misery and fear the whole time. And at the end, they had to give up. The other man had made one more trip to the abandoned lander, found the tool kit in it, managed to get it back to their own lander. Then they had taken off, leaving the two casualties peacefully frozen behind them. But they had overstayed their limit, and they were physical wrecks when they docked with the orbiter. I wasn't clear on what happened after that, but apparently they had failed to secure the lander's air supply and had lost a good deal of it, so they were on short oxygen rations all the way home. The other man was worse off than Sherry. There was a good chance of residual brain damage, and his $5,850,000 might not do him much good. But Sherry, they said, would be all right once she recovered from plane exhaustion. I didn't envy them the trip. All I envied them was the reward. I got up and got myself another cup of coffee in the commissary. As I brought it back to the corridor outside, where there were a few benches under the ivy planters, I became aware that something was bugging me. Something about the trip. About the fact that it had been a real winner, one of the all-time greats of Gateway's history. I dumped the coffee, cup and all, into a disposal hole outside the commissary and headed for the school room. It was only a few minutes away, and there was no one else there. That was good. I wasn't ready to talk to anyone yet about what had occurred to me. I keyed the P-phone to information access and got the settings for Sherry's trip. They were, of course, a matter of public record. Then I went down to the practice capsule, again hitting lucky because there was no one around, and set them up on the course selector. Of course, I got good color immediately, and when I pressed the fine tuner, the whole board turned bright pink, except for the rainbow of colors along the side. There was only one dark line in the blue part of the spectrum. Well, I thought, so much for Metchnikoff's theory about danger readings. They had lost 40% of the crew on that mission, and that struck me as being quite adequately dangerous. But according to what he had told me, the really hairy ones showed 6 or 7 of those bands. And in the yellow? According to Metchnikoff, the more bright bands in the yellow, the more financial reward from a trip. Only in this one, there were no bright bands in the yellow at all. There were 2 thick black absorption lines, that's all. I thumbed the selector off and sat back. So the great brains had labored and brought forth a mouse again. What they had interpreted as an indication of safety didn't really mean you were safe, and what they had interpreted as a promise of good results didn't seem to have any relevance to the first mission in more than a year that had really come up rich. Back to square one, and back to being scared. A note on neutron stars. Dr. Asminian. Now, you get a star that has used up its fuel, and it collapses. When I say collapses, I mean it's shrunk so far that the whole thing, that starts out with maybe the mass and volume of the sun, is squeezed into a ball maybe 10 kilometers across. That's dense. If your nose was made out of neutron star stuff, Susie, it would weigh more than Gateway does. Question. Maybe even more than you do, Yuri? Dr. Asminian. Don't make jokes in class. Teacher's sensitive. Anyway, good close-in readings on a neutron star would be worth a lot, but I don't advise you to use your lander to get them. You need to be in a fully armored 5, and then I wouldn't come much closer than a 10th of an AU. And watch it. It'll seem as if probably you could get closer, but the gravity shear is bad. It's practically a point source, you see. Steepest gravity gradient you'll ever see, unless you happen to get next to a black hole, God forbid. And a note on neutron stars. For the next couple of days, I kept pretty much to myself. There are supposed to be 800 kilometers of tunnels inside Gateway. You wouldn't think there could be that many in a little chunk of rock that's only about 10 kilometers across. But even so, only about 2% of Gateway is airspace. The rest is solid rock. I saw a lot of those 800 kilometers. I didn't cut myself off completely from human companionship. I just didn't seek it out. I saw Clara now and then. I wandered around with Shiki when he was off duty, although it was tiring for him. Sometimes I wandered by myself, sometimes with chance-met friends, sometimes tagging along after a tourist group. The guides knew me and were not averse to having me along. I had been out, even if I didn't wear a bangle, until they got the idea that I was thinking of guiding myself. Then they were less friendly. They were right. I was thinking of it. I was going to have to do something sooner or later. I would have to go out, or I would have to go home. And if I wanted to defer decision on either of those two equally frightening prospects, I would have to decide at least to try to make enough money to stay put. When Sherry got out of the hospital, we had a hell of a party for her, a combination of welcome home, congratulations, and goodbye. Sherry, because she was leaving for Earth the next day. She was shaky but cheerful, and although she wasn't up to dancing, she sat hugging me in the corridor for half an hour, promising to miss me. I got quite drunk. It was a good chance for it. The liquor was free. Sherry and her Cuban friend were picking up the check. In fact, I got so drunk that I never did get to say goodbye to Sherry because I had to head for the toilet and chuck. Drunk as I was, that struck me as a pity. It was genuine scotch from Scotland, Gleneagle. None of your local white lightning boiled out of God knows what. Throwing up cleared my head. I came out and leaned against a wall, my face buried in the ivy, breathing hard. And by, enough oxygen got into my bloodstream that I could recognize Francie Herrera standing next to me. I even said, "Hello, Francie." He grinned apologetically. The smell, it was a little strong. "Sorry," I said huffily, and he looked surprised. "No, what do you mean? I mean, it is bad enough on the cruiser, but every time I come to Gateway, I wonder how you lived through it, and in those rooms. Phew." "No offense taken," I said grandly, patting his shoulder. "I must say goodnight to Sherry." "She's gone, Bob. Got tired. They took her back to the hospital." "In that case," I said, "I will only say goodnight to you." I bowed and lurched down the tunnel. It is difficult being drunk in nearly zero gravity. You long for the reassurance of 100 kilos of solid weight to hold you to the ground. I understand, from what was reported to me later, that I pulled a solid rack of ivy off the wall, and I know from what I felt the next morning that I bashed my head into something hard enough to leave a purplish bruise the size of my ear. I became conscious of Francie coming up behind me and helping me navigate, and about halfway home I became conscious that there was someone else on my other arm. I looked, and it was Clara. I have only the most confused recollection of being put to bed, and when I woke up the next morning desperately hungover, I was astonished to find that Clara was in it too. I got up as inconspicuously as I could and headed for the bathroom, needing a lot to throw up some more. It took quite a while, and I topped it off with another shower, my second in 4 days, and a wild extravagance considering my financial state. But I felt a little better, and when I got back to my room, Clara had got up, fetched tea, probably from Shiki, and was waiting for me. "Thanks," I said, meaning it. I was infinitely dehydrated. "A sip at a time, old horse," she said anxiously, but I knew enough not to force much into my stomach. I managed 2 swallows and stretched out in the hammock again, but by then I was pretty sure I would live. "I didn't expect to see you here," I said. "You were, insistent," she told me, "not much on performance, but awfully anxious to try." "Sorry about that." She reached over and squeezed my foot. "Not to worry. How have things been, anyway?" "Oh, all right. It was a nice party. I don't remember seeing you there." She shrugged. "I came late. Wasn't invited, as a matter of fact." End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.